Chapter 18. Whittemore Justice. Whittemore's former partners at Wingfield Nevada Group, Tom Sino and Albert Sino Jr., have sued Whittemore, saying he used his smooth-talking, sleight-of-hand tactics to steal millions from the Wingfield Company. Whittemore shot back with his own lawsuit, claiming the Sinos threatened to kill him and his family if he didn't follow their orders and sign over his assets. Martha Belisle, Wit and Work made lobbyist Harvey Whittemore an institution. Reno Gazette Journal, February 12, 2012. A federal grand jury indicted former Nevada power broker Harvey Whittemore today on charges of funneling $138,000 to an elected official's campaign through family members and employees, and then lying to the FBI about it, the U.S. Attorney's Office said. David McGrath Schwartz, federal grand jury indicts former Nevada power broker Harvey Whittemore, Las Vegas Sun, June 6, 2012. Dr. Mikovits was at the Physicians Roundtable in Tampa, Florida in late January 2012 when she heard about the $44 million Sino lawsuit against the Whittemores. Since the suit was public record, she hurried to download it and pored over the 42-page complaint that named Harvey Whittemore, Annette Whittemore, and the Lakeshore House Limited Partnership, which took its name from their historic home in lush Glenbrook. The mystery of the previous year when she had seen such a change in the Whittemores came into stark relief. She thought of the time in late March 2011 when she had begun to see an unsavory side of the Whittemores, but this was a whole new scale. She thought she had been in a world of wealth and privilege with sincere dedication to unraveling neuroimmune diseases. The accusations in the lawsuit painted a picture of a dark and dangerous world. This is a case involving the misappropriation, breach of fiduciary duties, and embezzlement of tens of millions of dollars. Acting as manager of Wingfield, Whittemore has admitted and confessed to engaging in over 20 different financial transactions designed to deplete Wingfield of its assets, for the sole purpose of enhancing and promoting Whittemore's financial condition and to further his standing in the political community of Nevada. The Sinos alleged 10 causes of action against the Whittemores, including breach of fiduciary duties, breach of contract, civil conspiracy, and unjust enrichment. In early 2004, the Whittemores and Sinos forged a business partnership, and the Whittemores sold 50% of their interest in various companies to the Sinos, including Argus Media, Wild West Sound Company, Red Labs USA, since 2007 doing business as VIPDX, Dr. Pepper 7-Up Bottling Company of the West, and two companies associated with the massive Coyote Springs development and planning. All of these entities became part of the newly formed Wingfield Nevada Group Holding Company that was created on or around January 1, 2005. Harvey Whittemore was a manager of the holding company, and according to the Sino lawsuit, from February of 2007 through 2009, Whittemore exercised complete control over the financial books and records of Wingfield. Around September of 2010, the Sinos began to notice financial discrepancies. In or around September 2010, the Sinos confronted Whittemore with their suspicions. However, they quickly learned their suspicions, while well-founded, had not even scratched the surface of Whittemore's fraud, deception, and malfeasance. Confronted with some of the evidence uncovered regarding his potential fraudulent conduct, breach of fiduciary duties, and misdeeds, Whittemore confessed, admitted, and disclosed a multitude of acts that revealed years of theft, conversion, asset misappropriation, and breach of fiduciary duties to Wingfield. According to the lawsuit, Harvey Whittemore himself had prepared a written confession of his misdeeds on September 16, 2010, and gave it to the CINO representatives. Mikovits could not get over the irony of the situation. Harvey had tried to get her to sign a confession, in the form of an apology, in order to get her out of jail and wrap up the civil case. She had refused. Now the CINOs were claiming he had written his own confession regarding the theft of millions. As Mikovits read about the various monies allegedly embezzled by Harvey from Wingfield, the story got more incredible. To her surprise, she stumbled upon her own name in the CINO lawsuit. For example, defendant Annette Whittemore, who lacked management authority under Wingfield, mandated to the Wingfield accounting staff that 75% of the salary of Dr. Judy Mikovits, a research scientist and employee of WPI, would be charged to and paid by Wingfield. She had no idea she was indirectly salaried by the Wingfield company. In 2006, she had gone with Annette Whittemore to appear before the Nevada State Legislature to raise funds for the new institute. They were granted $600,000 for each of the first 2 years and $400,000 for the 2 years after that, for a total of $2 million in funds that included salary for Mikovits and the startup staff. Her understanding was that her salary came from these funds and the Whittemore Family Foundation. But if the Whittemores had not used the state money to pay for institute staff, and instead took salaries out of Wingfield, where had it gone? She called her attorneys, thinking this revelation meant things could turn in her favor. Her hearing on damages was set for a few days away. Maybe it would now never happen. The CINO lawsuit seemed to be unmasking Whittemore lies, but even in the volley of lawsuits, her attorneys were still dismissive. "These charges have nothing to do with your case," they told her. A few days later, the Whittemores filed a countersuit against the CINOs, claiming that the CINOs owed them $60 million. This amount of damages claimed by the Whittemores would later balloon to $1.8 billion. Mikovits delved into reading Whittemore's litigation as well, and it clarified some of the inexplicable moments she had observed in the last year of her work for the Whittemores. She recalled in April of 2011 when Annette Whittemore had missed a meeting by a couple of hours. Annette typically appeared at the WPI in crisp business suits, her hair nicely styled, and her makeup perfect, but this time she seemed shaken, was plain-faced without even mascara, and pulled Mikovits aside. Distraught, Annette told Mikovits that she had been at the house when an armored truck pulled up, and she was forced by a menacing thug to empty their safe of $50,000 and expensive jewelry. Harvey paced the halls near the cafe, talking on two cell phones, as if frantically trying to solve a serious problem. The story seemed suspicious to Mikovits and made her wonder if something more sinister was happening. When the Whittemores filed their $66 million countersuit against the CINOs on February 1, 2012, Mikovits read an account of this event. On one occasion, a large, very ominous and burly man named Ray demanded that Mr. Whittemore open a safe in the house. They assured Mr. Whittemore that they only wanted to see what was in it and that they would take nothing from the safe. Mr. Whittemore got the combination from Mrs. Whittemore, as it was her safe, and opened it for inspection. The large, burly man then dumped everything in the safe into a bag and took it with him. Taken from the safe was a portion of Mrs. Whittemore's jewelry and cash, leaving behind only Mrs. Whittemore's passport. They also took Mr. Whittemore's watches and jewelry. The CINOs demanded, and the Whittemores transferred, most all of their family automobiles and most other assets that they had to the CINOs, except for certain retirement accounts and insurance policies. Mikovits recalled another peculiar incident with Harvey. Her condominium at the Riverwalk had suffered mold damage, and at the Whittemores' urging, she had moved to a condo they owned at the Palladio. As the situation with the Cenos deteriorated, the Whittemores had moved out of their houses at Lake Shore and Boulder Glen, eventually settling in another condominium at the Palladio, a few floors above Mikovits. They had become neighbors. In September of 2011, the month in which she would later be fired, Judy saw Harvey pull up in a 10-year-old SUV and park on the street in front of the Palladio. Mikovits was dressed in her workout clothes, returning from the YMCA across the street as Harvey stood next to the vehicle, glancing from right to left in a seemingly paranoid way to see if anyone was watching. The SUV was filled with Whittemore possessions as they were apparently finishing up their move into the Palladio. Mikovits approached him and said pleasantly, "Hi, Harvey." She startled him, but when he saw her, he seemed to instinctively relax, as if he had been expecting someone or something else. Mikovits knew about some vague financial hot water, as Annette had at one point muttered something about how they had to give everything back. Harvey seemed humbled right then, even deflated. "They took our cars," he said, inhaling the crisp pre-autumn air. "They took our cars because we're bankrupt." Mikovits could only imagine how difficult the confession was for Harvey, who valued his ability to make a showman's entrance and impress everybody. Harvey's eyes darted up and down the street, as if he hoped nobody else would discover his secret shame. "Well, at least you have something to drive," said Mikovits brightly. "You don't need stuff." Mikovits had not known what to say, as the world of the uber-rich baffled her. Were the Whittemores actually destitute? If so, how could the WPI still function? What about their properties? Surely their vast fortune couldn't just evaporate. But of course, it didn't. She never saw the old SUV again, and their Cadillac SUV and Range Rover quietly reappeared. This just convinced Mikovits that they were on their way to solving their problems, and Harvey's woes had only been a minor blip. As described by the Whittemore lawsuit, the anger of the Cino family exploded into volcanic rage. Albert Cino Jr. threatened to go to the FBI with information that he alleged he had regarding these alleged improprieties, that he would personally bring down every member of the political machine in Nevada, including references to U.S. senators, that in the course of this threat asked whether Mr. Whittemore believed in God, whether Mr. Whittemore went to church, that Mr. Whittemore should gather his flock on Sunday and pray. Albert Cino Jr. threatened that when he was through with Mr. Whittemore, he would be disbarred and behind bars, that they would spend Mr. Whittemore into the ground, and there was no way he had the finances to defend himself, that he would bring down any business or friend associated with Mr. Whittemore, and that at Mr. Whittemore's funeral, there would not be one person in attendance. Mikovits could not help but notice that the actions supposedly taken by the Cinos mimicked those Harvey and Annette had done to her. She couldn't help but wonder if her September 2011 public disavowal of the XMRV test, which had potentially been worth millions, had thrown the Whittemores into a panic. It might have been the only significant asset they had to appease the Cinos, since the real estate market was in such trouble because of the recession. All of these allegations by the Whittemores painted a significantly different picture than the one soon presented in the pages of the Reno Gazette Journal later that month. Recounting the history of the Cino family business, the article of February 25, 2011, reported how the grandfather of Albert Cino Jr., Gaetano Cino, had helped rebuild San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake and had started Cino Homes in 1938, and how a friendship with Reno businessman Bill Paganetti led them to open the Peppermill Hotel Casino in the late 1970s. Of the Cinos, Paganetti said, Paganetti called Whittemore's allegations beyond fiction. He said he had been in business with the Cinos for 33 years and has never had an argument or crossword with either brother. These people are the salt of the earth. These people are good businessmen. I could live 100 lifetimes and not have another partnership like this. While the Cino image was fluffed a bit in the article, it still pretty much matched their track record. In the course of running various business entities with a value estimated at more than $4 billion, the list of alleged violations by the Cinos comprised less than a handful. In the Reno Gazette Journal, Albert Cino Jr. pointed out that as a casino owner, he was continually under scrutiny of state regulators, and that Nevada gaming laws required he avoid all activities which discredit the state. Gaming officials have access to and can take control of all records, including phone and travel, at any time, he said. Cino said he has complied and cooperated with all regulators and regulations. I'm not aware of any disciplinary actions involving the Cinos, said Mark Liparelli, chairman of the Gaming Control Board. The Cinos' picture of Harvey Whittemore was, on the other hand, consistent with what Mikovits had observed since her discovery of the problems with the Lombardi and XMRV serology in the blood working group in the months before she was fired. The Cino lawsuit painted Harvey Whittemore as a devious, manipulative man of cutthroat ambition who would stop at little to keep his position. His connections also meant he could pull some pretty large strings to defend his high status, even when his connections didn't know they were being played. Mikovits believed that the Whittemores had set things up so she would be in a one-down position. The joining of the criminal and civil cases created a situation in which she could not defend against either case. Invoking her Fifth Amendment rights in the civil case was a strategy proposed by her lawyer, Scott Freeman, as a result of the two cases being so closely intertwined. Even if the judge eventually found that she could not invoke her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination, it was beyond belief that he had summarily taken away her right to a jury trial and entered a default judgment, something Judge Adams had never done in 22 years on the bench. A common cliché about the legal system is that the wheels of justice moved slowly, but in her case, it seemed like a runaway train. Less than 6 weeks had passed between the filing of the civil suit on November 7, 2011, to the December 19th hearing where Judge Adams had entered a default judgment against her. In retrospect, Mikovits believed the December 19, 2011 hearing before Judge Adams was probably the high watermark of the Whittemore's campaign against her. The lawsuit by the Cinos suggested a pattern of dishonest dealings by the Whittemores, and more fallout seemed to be on the way. Mikovits could never have imagined that the next act in this drama would involve the most powerful man in Congress, the majority leader of the United States Senate, Senator Harry Reid of Nevada. On February 8, 2012, roughly 24 FBI agents served subpoenas on business associates and friends of the Whittemores in about 30 locations in southern and northern Nevada. The Las Vegas Review-Journal ran a story a few days later about the chain of events leading up to the FBI action. Contributions made on one date, March 31, 2007, to the re-election campaign of Senator Harry Reid, the Democratic majority leader, have attracted the interest of FBI agents, sources said. On that day, Reid's campaign received $115,000 from about 24 Whittemore employees and their family members, most of whom each contributed the maximum allowed $4,600, according to federal campaign reports. As the Las Vegas Review-Journal noted in an article published on February 20, 2012, regarding the gathering storm that centered on Harvey, the big splash FBI agents made February 8th when they simultaneously served subpoenas across the state in their campaign contribution investigation of power broker Harvey Whittemore was designed to interview witnesses before they had a chance to get their stories straight. When Mikovits first read about the FBI actions, she recoiled in horror. She realized she had inadvertently been part of such a conduit scheme designed to funnel money to Harry Reid. Only it had not been in 2007 when Harry Reid was raising money for other candidates, but in February of 2010, when Reid himself was up for re-election and facing a formidable challenger. A Harry Reid fundraising event took place at the Whittemore home. It was a keystone soiree since it was slated to be Harry Reid's last election, and he faced stiff competition from his Republican opponent, Sharon Angle, who had Republican Party support and was also a Tea Party favorite. Like all Whittemore events, this one was catered to the hilt. After getting a drink, Mikovits mingled and greeted Harry Reid, wishing him well in the re-election. Harvey came up a few minutes later and said he needed to talk to Mikovits. In the front of the house, Harvey and Annette shared an office, with two grand mahogany desks facing each other holding computers. Harvey gathered a few other people together along with Mikovits and shepherded them into his office, one at a time, where Annette joined them. Harvey rhapsodized about the importance of the WPI, emphasizing how it wouldn't exist without Harry Reid's help, and impressing the point that everyone should contribute to his re-election. There was no doubt, he said, that Reid's Republican opponent would feel very differently about the WPI. Mikovits said she would be happy to contribute, but did not have that kind of money. She noted she hadn't been paid her bonus in a couple of years. If she got her bonus, she could probably make the maximum donation of $9,400 with her husband, but David complained. They needed the money for their own families, but Harvey made it clear if Reid was not reelected, she would have no job. She thought it had all been legal, but it was not. The Las Vegas Review-Journal article captured the attributes of Harvey and the case. In 2007, Whittemore, who considered U.S. Senator Harry Reid, Democrat Nevada, among his closest friends, was orchestrating the development of Coyote Springs, a master-planned community in southern Nevada. With the help of Reid and other members of Nevada's congressional delegation, Whittemore sought to overcome several governmental hurdles because of county water issues and federal land issues. To Mikovits, it seemed as if the FBI believed it had assembled most of the puzzle. She wished they could see the even greater picture, including what had happened at the WPI. The Sino case and the FBI investigation were not isolated events to Mikovits, but seemed typical of how Harvey Whittemore behaved when squeezed in a corner. The scale of what Harvey had attempted was breathtaking. But there it all was in black and white in the pages of the Las Vegas Review. The article noted that the contributions made on March 31, 2007 to the Reid campaign had attracted the attention of FBI agents. On that day, the Senate Majority Leader's campaign received at least $133,400 from 29 Whittemore associates, including his family members and his employees and their spouses, most of whom contributed the maximum allowed $4,600, according to federal campaign reports. The article reported that the number had gone up since the initial reports, and there were those who saw this as one of the largest campaign contribution cases in recent history. Gross, former head of enforcement for the Federal Elections Commission in Washington, said he had never seen that amount of money bundled all at once in a federal race. "I can't recall another situation where that much came in on a single day," he said. Mikovits told Freeman and Riggs she wanted to go to the FBI and tell them everything she knew about Harvey's dealings. Her criminal attorneys told her she was crazy to consider this, as she was still under indictment, released to their recognizance, and if she insisted on going forward, she could find another attorney. Their opinion was that if the FBI didn't come looking for her, she shouldn't go looking for them. Mikovits felt much differently. She felt a moral obligation to tell the truth, regardless of the cost. It wasn't until a few months later when she talked to her bankruptcy attorney, David Fallon, whom she then learned was also an experienced criminal attorney, that she realized she had a legal professional willing to back her, and she could wager the risk of her speaking to the FBI. In late July of 2012, Fallon arranged a conversation for her with the FBI. The FBI had a program with the unofficial title, Queen for a Day. A potential witness could come in and talk about a pending investigation, and the FBI promised it would not use any of the information gathered in the meeting against the informant. Mikovits had to pay her attorney more than $1,000 for the 3 hours the FBI agent spent in the attorney's office talking to the informant. She detailed everything to the FBI agent, who in turn expressed concern that her testimony might be too complicated. "What's complicated?" she responded incredulously. "He did the same thing in 2010 that he did in 2007. In November of 2012, she received word that the FBI did not believe it would need her testimony, although that might change. She had wanted the opportunity to stand up in a court of law and tell the truth about Harvey, but there was nothing else she could do. She may have made a mistake by giving money to Reed in 2010 at Harvey's urging, but she wasn't the only one, and she had come clean about it to the authorities. Just when it seemed that things couldn't get any stranger, they did. In March of 2012, while talking with Jones in the midst of an unrelated hearing, Judge Adams disclosed he had received a total of $10,400 in campaign contributions from Harvey Whittemore, his family, and his company. This was the same judge who had issued the default judgment against Mikovits in the civil case, for which the WPI was looking for damages from Mikovits of $15 million. If the civil action against Mikovits had taken place in California, where Mikovits was living with her husband, the judge would have had to consult the California Code of Judicial Ethics, which runs 53 pages. By comparison, the Nevada Code of Judicial Conduct is 6 pages long. The rule in California is that a judge must disclose to the other side any contribution made to his campaign of more than $100 by a party or lawyer who appears before him. California law also holds that a judge must disqualify himself if one of the parties before him has given more than $1,500 to his campaign. Nevada has no rules on the amount of money a judge may receive before he is required to disclose that information to the other side, or disqualify himself from the case. While judges in Nevada are required to avoid both impropriety and the appearance of impropriety, the judge himself makes a call about these ethical gray zones. In essence, the judge gets to judge his own behavior. If Judge Adams had been on the bench in California and had failed to reveal the $10,400 in contributions, he would have been subject to an investigation for violation of both California law and the California Code of Judicial Ethics. Punishment could have ranged from a fine to being stripped of his judicial robes. With the Whittemores now under swarming legal and media scrutiny, Mikovits noticed that her own attorneys were treating her more favorably. It was suddenly as if they fully believed her and were listening with sharper ears. She had been puzzled by the sometimes rote behavior of her lawyers. She knew she had been under stress, as anyone would be, in disbelief at the unfolding events, and on most occasions in their presence she had been angry and distraught. But all of this seemed a reasonable reaction to something so overwhelming and traumatizing. In fact, she thought she behaved a good deal like the cancer patients she dealt with in support groups, who were facing the very real possibility they might die. She had just never taken it personally when they became angry and upset. She had also never yelled at any of the patients. She felt her criminal attorneys seemed to yell at her quite frequently when they should have been level-headed. On March 7, 2012, a settlement offer was made by the Whittemore's attorney, Ann Hall, and conveyed by email. The offer listed several things which had been discussed before: return of the notebooks, an apology from Mikovits, paying more than $450,000 in legal fees, the two sides would refrain from publicly criticizing each other, and the WPI would tell the district attorney that they considered the matter closed. For Mikovits, this offer bent the facts and was as ludicrous as both the civil and the criminal cases, and she conveyed her feelings clearly to her attorneys. On March 8, 2012, she wrote back to her attorneys, "All original notebooks are in custody. I did absolutely nothing wrong and will not apologize for being wrongfully terminated in an attempt to prevent Whittemore crimes and will not pay a penny for their frivolous lawsuit." Her professional and financial life was at stake. An apology was an admission she had committed wrongdoing, and she strongly believed she had not done so. If she gave a scripted, bogus apology, she doubted she would ever work in science again. More importantly, how could she face the patients if she sold them out to protect herself? The truth was the truth. For his part, Dennis Neal Jones was trying to settle the matter in a way which did not devastate her financially, although he appreciated $450,000 was financial devastation to someone who rarely had more than a few thousand dollars in any bank account. On March 9, 2012, he wrote to Mikovits, "I understand how frustrating the civil and the criminal cases are for you, but please don't lash out at me. I'm trying to help you. I am not the judge. I do not make the legal rulings in the case. I am also obligated to provide my analysis regarding any settlement offer, so that you can make an informed decision. You say that you will never apologize and you will never pay WPI anything. I get that. I just want to make absolutely sure that you understand the probable implications of your position. The judge doesn't care about the new civil case against the Whittemores. He doesn't care whether politicians are refunding the Whittemores' political contributions. Those new developments will not cause the judge to throw the case out of court." No wonder everybody was screaming at each other. It was like a medical and criminal action thriller on the big screen, too unreal to comprehend. But with the news media reports about Harvey, at least one of her attorneys seemed to understand that he needed to broaden his grasp of what was happening. Her criminal attorney, Scott Freeman, told Mikovits she needed to fly to Reno and he would have a Dr. Judy Mikovits day. She could talk to him as much as she needed until she had nothing left to say. He had copies of all the notebooks and other documents in his office. So, on March 12, 2012, Mikovits flew to Reno to spend the day with Scott Freeman and Tammy Riggs to prove her innocence. The first item they tackled was the notebooks, which Mikovits had not seen since she had been fired on September 29, 2011. In their damages claim, the Whittemores were asking for the salary they had paid Mikovits for the previous 5 years and the cost of the entire research program, including Peterson's salary, WPI parties, and travel costs paid by patient organizations. Using her calendar and the copies of the notebooks, she had been able to correlate every day she was at the lab with the work she had written down in a notebook. The notebooks did not leave her lab and office ever, so whenever she had taken a trip, she had recorded the information separately, then transcribed it when she returned. In Katie Hagen's notebook, she was able to go to the page marked March 23, 2009, and find where Lombardi had directed Hagen to culture approximately 30 patient samples together with the LNCAP cells producing XMRV in Mikovits's research lab rather than the clinical lab, curiously, while Mikovits had been out of town. As she explained to Freeman and Riggs, this was a direct violation of all sound scientific protocol, and from what they had learned subsequently about the ability of XMRV to spread through the air, it was a serious problem, and the reason Mikovits had been so methodical about dividing up the lab work to prevent contamination. The entire staff had been told this, and Hagen had taped the instructions in her notebook. Rossetti and Mikovits were furious at this breach of their instructions. While Mikovits believed that Silverman's VP62 clone and 22RV1 prostate cancer line had never been in her labs, which meant that she had cultured an XMRV-like retrovirus from at least one patient, it did raise the issue of contamination in the research lab. Lombardi had denied that he had ever cultured an XMRV sample in the clinical lab or research lab, and Mikovits believed him until she found the entry in Hagen's notebook on July 8, 2011, as things started to deteriorate. Technically, he had told the truth. He had, in fact, directed the lab technician Katie Hagen to do the culture. When Mikovits had uncovered this fact and the next day disclosed it to Harvey and Annette Whittemore, Annette blamed it on Mikovits, saying in an email that Mikovits should have known what her employees were doing. A scientist needed to have absolute trust in the integrity of her collaborators, or else the entire structure fell apart. On March 12, 2012, Mikovits noted that the only missing item from her desk drawers was the loose 4 pages Lombardi had copied from his notebook when she had confronted him over Silverman's assertion that Lombardi had sent him samples in March 2009. However, Lombardi was never authorized to send samples to anyone. What the hell was going on? She had demanded he document to her what he had been doing since he had been transferred to the clinical lab after the debacle at the Cleveland Clinic in November 2009, a time period of almost 2 years. So then he had produced for her just 4 Xeroxed pages documenting that he had indeed done no work on the NIH grants while still requesting salary support. She had put those pages in Hagen's notebook, marking the page, and told both Carly West Kinney and Harvey and Annette Whittemore that he was not to be paid for fiscal year 2010 to 2011. Now they were missing from the materials in Freeman's office. Another issue that had confounded the attorneys, vital to the criminal case, was the alleged contract she had signed on February 22, 2009, with the WPI, in which she allegedly promised that all copies of her data and intellectual property were the sole property of the WPI and would be returned upon her termination. The only glitch was that she had never signed the document, nor even seen it, until a month after she was fired when it was mailed to her home. Mikovits explained to Freeman why she believed it was a forgery. For one thing, she had started 3 years earlier, on November 15, 2006, and this was certainly not the email contract agreement she had worked under since that date. Even more bizarre, the date on the document had been changed to October 2008 in handwriting that was not Mikovits's. She had signed the collaboration agreement with the National Cancer Institute and the Cleveland Clinic on January 22, 2009. That document made it clear that any intellectual property generated by the collaboration was owned equally by the three institutions. She would not then have signed a second contract the next month, contradicting the January one. The pagination on the signature page was also different than the rest of the contract, and the font was different. Mikovits wondered if it had been taken from an unrelated document she had signed on February 22, 2009, that was not the cut-and-pasted contract they now had. But the signature of the new date clearly did not belong to her. She made her O's and T's in a very distinctive manner that was apparently, by the forger, inimitable. Freeman listened carefully and looked at examples of her signatures and date, along with the signature and new date on the so-called contract page. Freeman did so with a magnifying glass and then asked Tammy Riggs to come over and peer closer. They concurred it did not look like her handwriting. Mikovits felt they must have added in the October 2008 date when they realized the February 2009 date was after they had generated preliminary data on XMRV and the inflammatory cytokine signature. In fact, all of the intellectual property belonging to Mikovits had been generated before February 2009. When Scott and Tammy had magnified the seeming forgery and saw it with their own eyes, Mikovits could almost feel the climate shift. Mikovits went on to show she could account for every notebook entry and every date when she was not in the lab for the entire 5.5 years. Clearly, there were no missing notebooks. At the end of the day, Scott Freeman was beaming. "How come you never lie?" he asked her. Mikovits couldn't get over the question. Scientists were supposed to tell the truth, just as was supposed to happen in the legal system. Why was actual honesty such a rare thing? The following day, March 13, 2012, Scott Freeman and Tammy Riggs met with Harvey and Annette Whittemore, Lombardi, and their attorney, Ann Hall. Mikovits was not there, but when her attorneys called later that day, they sounded elated. They had reviewed the notebooks to show that Mikovits had worked diligently for 5 years, and everything was recorded and present, so the Whittemore team's claim that she owed them her salary for that time, or that original notebooks be returned, was baseless. They also showed that every notebook was accounted for. They directly pointed out the page on which Lombardi directed Katie Hagen to culture XMRV in Mikovits's research lab. Freeman and Riggs went on to say how they were able to discuss how Lombardi had not been entitled to the cell line, which they had used to justify firing Mikovits, and said they felt comfortable they could prove that in a court of law. Then they discussed the supposed contract and the difficulties they thought the Whittemores would have in proving that Mikovits had actually signed it. They described Annette Whittemore and Lombardi as white as ghosts, and Hall still attempting to maintain there were missing notebooks. About 2 weeks later, Mikovits got a courtesy call from Scott Freeman. He wanted to tell her personally that he had been appointed to the bench and would now be a judge. He would commence that position immediately, so could not continue representing her, but his partner would do so. 2 days later, on March 14, 2012, Mikovits was in San Francisco meeting with a biotech company when her civil attorney, Dennis Jones, and her husband, David, called. Jones had been meeting with the Whittemores to discuss the damages in the civil suit. Jones said there was a new offer on the table and suggested she take it. If Mikovits signed a letter of apology, the civil suit would be settled and they wouldn't even ask for legal fees. The criminal charges would be dropped immediately. Her signature on a letter of apology and promise never to speak of these events again would end everything. David, battle-weary and wanting to move forward, suggested she sign it as well. Mikovits wasn't tempted. She explained to her husband and her lawyer that they did not understand that to sign an apology that was a lie and never discuss the crimes committed against her and the patients would end everything. It would effectively end her life. Dennis Jones objected, but Mikovits remained firm. The offer was withdrawn. The Sino family lawsuit against the Whittemores, as well as the Whittemore countersuit, would eventually be settled in February of 2013, but the truth or falsity of the accusations in both cases would remain hidden from view. At that time, James Pisanelli, the Sino family's Las Vegas lawyer, released a statement which read, "The parties have reached a comprehensive settlement of all pending litigation. The financial terms of the settlement are confidential, and the Sino-WNG parties offer no comment as to the litigation or any aspect of the agreement at this time, except that all litigation by and between the parties will be dismissed." The outcome was disappointing to Mikovits. She'd wanted the facts to be revealed to all in a court of law, not silenced forever, as they attempted to extort her into silence. Jones continued to press her case. On April 25, 2012, he filed a motion for the new judge to set aside the default judgment. The motion was everything Mikovits could have asked for, although Jones was not optimistic about its chances. The new judge, Janet Berry, who would rule on the motion, still had to work with Judge Adams, and Jones felt no judge would rule against another sitting judge. Still, it felt good to see her side of the story presented in the motion. Judge Adams recently confirmed the existence of bias because, one, he accepted substantial campaign contributions from Harvey Whittemore, co-founder of the Whittemore Peterson Institute and president of its several affiliated companies, from Whittemore's family members, and from a company with which Whittemore is or was closely affiliated. Two, Mr. Whittemore is the target of an FBI probe and a grand jury investigation into illegal campaign contributions. 3. The criminal investigation of Mr. Whittemore, as well as a fraud suit filed recently by Thomas and Albert Sino, alleging that Mr. Whittemore converted and improperly dispersed funds from the same corporation that contributed $5,000 to Judge Adams's re-election campaign, has garnered intense media scrutiny. 4. Two congressmen recently called upon everyone who accepted campaign contributions from Mr. Whittemore, including Judge Adams, to donate those contributions to charity. And 5. Judge Adams is unable to donate the money he received from Mr. Whittemore and his affiliates to charity. None of the foregoing facts were disclosed to Mikovits or her counsel until the day before Judge Adams recused himself, March 16, 2012, even though Judge Adams knew about the tainted donations the very first day the case was assigned to him. Judge Adams also admitted to imposing against Dr. Mikovits the most severe sanction he has ever imposed in a civil case, the striking of her answer. Because she attempted to assert her constitutionally protected right against self-incrimination in response to a preliminary injunction issued by Judge Adams. Significantly, at the time of the hearing on plaintiff's motion for preliminary injunction, Dr. Mikovits was in custody in California on a bail imposed by the Washoe County District Attorney, presumably at Mr. Whittemore's request. Mikovits was pleased with how her attorney had set up the facts, but also how it impacted the fundamental justice of her case. Jones went through the enormous political influence of Harvey Whittemore and the allegation he'd orchestrated Mikovits's criminal arrest, just as she was trying to respond to the preliminary injunction in the civil case. Then Judge Adams struck Dr. Mikovits's answer, denied her motion to stay this action pending resolution of the criminal case, and denied all other requested relief, thereby handing plaintiff a win by default. This case and the companion criminal case stink of undue influence and bias. Judge Adams's belated recusal does not restore the scales of justice to an equal balance, because he has already irreparably damaged her case by ordering her answer stricken, entering her default, granting a permanent injunction, and ordering that she cannot take any discovery or even introduce evidence at the damages hearing. Jones also argued that bringing in a new judge just to hear damages did not restore the parties to an even playing field. The civil case should be restarted from the beginning. The motion had presented all the arguments Mikovits wanted the court to hear, but also what her supporters in the patient and scientific communities needed to see exposed. Jones pulled no punches in laying out exactly what he viewed as the facts. Mikovits was a nationally renowned scientist and a principal investigator on several government grants for which she held the ultimate authority for funds, materials, and protocols. Jones continued, Dr. Mikovits's relationship with WPI deteriorated after she discovered a series of improper, unethical, and possibly illegal acts by the Whittemores and Vincent Lombardi, the lab director at VIPDX. These acts included, but were not limited to, 1. The Whittemores arranging to pay one half of Dr. Lombardi's salary out of WPI funds obtained via federal grants, even though Dr. Lombardi did no work at WPI, but was instead employed full-time at VIPDX. 2. Ordering a research assistant to misuse cells allocated for nonprofit research to harvest supplies for the for-profit VIPDX clinic, and then covering up the misappropriation for 2 years. 3. Selling blood tests through VIPDX, even after those tests had been invalidated as unreliable, thereby committing Medicare fraud. And 4. Failing to validate serological assays. As Jones had predicted, the new judge was unwilling to go against another sitting member of the bench. The motion was denied. Judge Barry set the date of the damages hearing for September 6, 2012. That hearing would never be held. While the Whittemores were prevailing in the civil case against Mikovits, they were not faring so well with the FBI and the grand jury. On June 6, 2012, Harvey Whittemore was indicted on federal charges of election violations. An article in the Las Vegas Sun a few days later captured the contradictions of this near-mythical figure. Harvey Whittemore once bounded through Nevada's legislature as the embodiment of influence, a lobbyist for casinos and other powerful interests, a lawyer, a gregarious personality, and sharp mind. He was also a lucrative campaign contributor for elected officials, which helped open doors. The article described Whittemore as somebody who pushed boundaries, like the installation of a private pier at his home on Lake Tahoe. Mikovits recalled the many times she'd stood on that very pier as Harvey pulled up in one of his speedboats, encouraging everybody to jump in and speed across the lake to a restaurant. And there were the darker aspects to his character, such as the tall glass walls that the legislature had installed in the Senate and Assembly chambers to keep those in the public gallery separated from the lawmakers. They quickly became known as Harvey Walls because of Whittemore's well-known penchant for reaching into the chambers before votes on legislation. But all that was of little importance as Whittemore entered the courtroom in a dark suit and shackles around his ankles to offer his plea to the four federal charges against him for crimes against the democratic process. The article described the courtroom hearing as surreal, as the room was filled with reporters, friends, family, and lawyers. The reporter noted he couldn't get many people to go on the record to be quoted, but the connections between Harvey and the powerful in Nevada ran all the way to the judge, William Cobb, who'd known Whittemore for close to 40 years and admitted to having a close relationship with Whittemore. The article recorded that Judge Cobb even admitted feeling a little bit ridiculous when he asked Whittemore to state his full name for the record. When Mikovits's criminal attorney, Scott Freeman, had phoned to let her know he could no longer serve as her attorney on March 29, 2012, he had assured her that the criminal charges were on their way to being dismissed in the next week. But that did not happen. Each hearing, scheduled in March, April, and May, was postponed with no reason given. The waiting was agony for Mikovits, but her advisors and friends told her it was simply a matter of time before things started turning in her favor. The district attorney for Washoe County filed for dismissal of the criminal charges against Mikovits on June 11, 2012, only 4 days after Harvey was indicted. Her supporters cheered this new direction, but Mikovits could not help but believe the charges had not been dropped sooner in order to prevent her from bringing evidence of another conduit scam against Whittemore. This scam would directly involve and benefit the WPI. John Cohen, the writer for Science, even popped up with a quick email a few days later asking for an update of her current work. Mikovits could not believe his casualness, as if she had just emerged from some quotidian debate. Was he completely oblivious about what had happened? She wrote him back and tried to keep any anger tempered, saying simply, "The publication by you and Science of my mugshot without my permission and with the refusal of the Ventura judge and my attorney has caused irreparable damage." Cohen responded by writing back, claiming that the mugshot brought sympathy and goodwill her way, and if there was any damage caused to her reputation, it was the fault of the Whittemore-Peterson Institute and the Washoe County District Attorney's Office. Mikovits ripped into him in a subsequent email for what she considered to be their tabloid-like sensationalism of her case. "Science promoted my defamation. That picture provided no sympathy, only disgust and fear. Many of my colleagues found its publication so reprehensible as to vow never to read or submit to Science again. You may not have created the story, but you sensationalized it without merit or balance to the destruction of my 30-plus year career. Others lied to you or covered their mistakes. You chose to not report the Silverman mistake, which was paramount as a mistake, but instead to destroy me when I was conveniently charged with a fictitious felony and could not defend myself. You should be ashamed of yourself. At least I have my integrity." Cohen continued on in his defense, writing back that he was proud of the coverage by Science, and that there was never any attempt to harm her reputation. He said he was contacting her because of what he imagined was very good news, the dropping of the criminal charges, which had always struck him as bizarre and extraordinary. Eventually, Mikovits relented and gave a short interview to Cohen. What else was she going to do? Retreat into silence? How would that help her repair the damage? He then published a brief article in the Science Insider, hardly the type of thing to restore her reputation, but perhaps better than nothing. At least Cohen seemed to make an effort at remediating the harm. The article was entitled, "Criminal Charges Dropped Against Chronic Fatigue Syndrome Researcher Judy Mikovits." Cohen's article noted that the charges had been dismissed without prejudice, which meant that a complaint could still be filed in the future, then noted the bizarre twists in the case. The judge in the civil case who ruled against her removed himself from the case when it was revealed he'd received significant campaign contributions from Harvey Whittemore, who was himself now charged with making illegal campaign contributions. Cohen continued, "Assistant District Attorney John Helzer, who filed the dismissal, says Whittemore's legal troubles factored into his decision. There's a lot going on with the federal government and different levels that wasn't occurring when we first became involved with prosecuting this case," says Helzer, "and we have witness issues that have arisen. The witness issues that had arisen were, of course, related to Max Post, Mikovits's former research associate, who had disavowed his earlier affidavit." "Let me give you some advice," her criminal attorney Tammy Riggs told Mikovits, minutes after informing her the criminal charges were dismissed. "I want you to understand what it means when the district attorney dismisses charges against you without prejudice. It means he can come back at any time within the statute of limitations and say they have new evidence and refile the charges. I also want to explain slander." "But that's ridiculous," Mikovits had interrupted. "They don't have any evidence, and it's not slander if it's the truth. I have emails and witnesses to back up every word I have ever said. I don't know where Harvey is getting the money, but he has it, and he will bury you the next time. Go live your life, because you are lucky you are not in jail in Nevada, as you would never get out," Riggs said. "What life do I have? Since I was 12 years old, I have dedicated my life to the chronically ill. I am a research scientist." But Mikovits had a sinking feeling that Riggs was right. The idea that she had eluded Harvey's clutches but still was not out of danger was shared by her civil attorney, Dennis Neal Jones. Mikovits was ready to make the damages hearing scheduled on September 6, 2012, the civil trial she had been denied. She compiled a list of 97 witnesses, patients, and scientists, including Ian Lipkin, Frank Rossetti, and even John Coffin, who could testify that she had done her job and had not only done no damage to the WPI, but had been a benefit to the Institute. "We're not going," Jones said. Mikovits became very agitated and excited, saying that this needed to be done. "Look at you," said Jones. "You're upset and you're yelling." "You'd yell too. I have put up with this farce long enough. I'm going to defend myself. I'm going to show the truth. I have hundreds of emails. I have all of these witnesses, and they will come and I will pay for it." "You don't have the money," Jones said. Mikovits replied, "I'll sell my houses. They're coming, and I will—" Jones swiftly cut her off. "You're being irrational. Do you think that if you go into that courtroom and you tell the truth, and you're calm and collected, you expose the fraud, you expose Harvey and Annette Whittemore, and all the reporters are there, do you honestly think you will walk out of that courthouse? Do you think that the DA won't be standing there with handcuffs and leg shackles to take you back to jail for new evidence that he just discovered? That's ridiculous. There's no new evidence, replied Mikovits. In a cold but not unfriendly voice, he said, they didn't have any the first time, did they? She got that nauseated feeling again. She knew that if she was arrested again, this time in Reno, that they would not have the money to pay a bail bondsman, and she might be locked up for a very long time. The previous time she had been in jail, it had nearly destroyed David. What would another false imprisonment do to her husband? For several weeks, Jones had been trying to convince her to file bankruptcy. You want me to file the bankruptcy, don't you? She asked him. He started going over the points he had already made to her several times. Taking a Chapter 7 bankruptcy stays everything. There's no liability to the default judgment against you. You'll be able to get a job. It freezes everything. There is nothing in the courts. There's nothing that says you did anything. You can go on with your life. It seemed like a lawyer's trick, but there was no other viable option. She had kept herself from being convicted as a criminal, but even if uncuffed, her hands were still tied. But she was not free either, not with the threat of $15 million in damages being assessed against her by a biased judicial system. Taking the bankruptcy was the only way to stop the madness. But it was still not the justice she wanted. It was not even close. The plain truth was, she could not go back to her life. She was a research scientist, and she had been unjustly disenfranchised. Nobody would touch her. Now, like the patients, she had to face the fact that she could never again do those things she loved the most. On May 29, 2013, following a two-week jury trial, Harvey Whittemore was convicted on one count of making excessive campaign contributions, one count of making contributions in the name of others, and one count of causing a materially false statement to be made to the Federal Elections Commission. In a press release issued by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, Acting U.S. Assistant Attorney General Mythili Raman said, today, a jury convicted Mr. Whittemore of using dozens of straw donors to evade contribution limits so he could make good on a campaign fundraising promise. The cornerstone of our campaign finance laws is contribution limits and transparency, and Mr. Whittemore's crime was designed to undermine both. Today's verdict demonstrates our resolve to aggressively pursue those who use illegal tricks to corrupt our democratic process. The conviction had the potential to send Harvey Whittemore to jail for 5 years and pay a $250,000 fine on each of the three felonies of which he was convicted. The government's sentencing memorandum summarized the case against Harvey Whittemore and the three charges of which he had been convicted. After promising Senator Harry Reid, a candidate for re-election to the U.S. Senate, in February 2007, that he would raise a total of $150,000 in campaign contributions, Whittemore sought to make good on his promise by using employees of his real estate development company, his family members, and many of their spouses as straw or conduit donors. On a single day, he caused one of his employees to transmit $138,000 in contributions, the vast majority of which he had unlawfully funded. The government asked for Whittemore to be sentenced to 4 years and 3 months in prison, 3 years of supervised release, and a fine of $133,400, the amount of Whittemore's illegal campaign contributions. The sentencing hearing was held on September 30, 2013, before District Court Judge Larry Hicks, starting at 1:33 p.m. and not ending until nearly 6 hours later at 7:14 p.m., an uncommonly long time for such a hearing. To say it was a hard-fought hearing on both sides would be an understatement. Whittemore's attorney, Dominic Gentile, discussed Whittemore's well-documented charitable activities and good character as grounds for a reduction in sentence. Eventually, Harvey Whittemore took the stand to accept responsibility for what he had done, but also to offer an explanation. "I didn't do this for greed. I didn't do this for power. I didn't do it for any other reason other than a friend asked me to raise money. I didn't want anything. I didn't need anything. I didn't need to be ingratiated. I didn't need a pat on the head. A person asked me to help him. I did it in a way that was wrong. I humbly ask that you look upon this life's work and my conduct and find that it is worthy of a variance below the guidelines." This drew a swift rebuke from Assistant United States Attorney Steve Meyer, who said, "This is a very serious offense, and we've heard sort of an almost schizophrenic argument from the defense. On the one hand, it's serious, but oh, really not that serious. I accept responsibility, but not really." Mr. Whittemore said that he believed his conduct was lawful, that he was naive and perhaps arrogant to believe that his conduct was lawful, but oh my goodness, I gave myself bad advice, and I accept that the jury found me guilty. It's a far cry from any expression of remorse. He's guilty of knowfully and willfully violating the law. And the law he violated strikes at the very heart of our election process, the very cornerstone of our government. Meyer went on to note that at one point during the trial, Harvey Whittemore's attorney represented that Whittemore was worth $300 million, but then proceeded to what he considered to be the heart of the matter. "This was about a campaign contribution, 3 years before the election, a campaign contribution pledge that he made at the very time that he's sitting on 30,000 acres in southern Nevada that will forever seal his fortune, seal his wealth. And that pledge, that campaign pledge, he went to the extent of committing a felony offense so that he could maintain his status, his level of influence, his level of accessibility to the senator." Judge Hicks had a few things to say about Harvey Whittemore and the case. "Now, before me, I have this man, Harvey Whittemore, who I have personally known over the years and known the family, or known of the family, not close personal friends, but at least to the level of people you say hello to when you pass in the hallway and you appreciate seeing them. I have a man here who he and his wife have, I mean, in the way they've treated their family, the way they've treated their friends, are reflected in the letters that have been received by the court. And I can tell you that those letters are absolutely incredible. This man is a fine family man. This man has done great things in this community. And these are not things that are to be treated lightly." During trial, the issue of Harvey Whittemore's character had come up, and the letters he had received. Assistant United States Attorney Steve Meyer compared the Whittemore saga to The Wizard of Oz. Meyer argued before the court, "And you recall in that story how Dorothy and her three imaginary friends are confronted with a big screen of this larger-than-life person, and there's all sorts of smoke and mirror and loud noises and booming voices and these images that just scare the daylights out of those people. But it's not until Dorothy's little dog Toto runs over and pulls a curtain back that you see that behind all the loud noises and the smoke and the mirrors and the lights is someone manipulating some controls, manipulating the scene, if you will." And you recall the classic response that the wizard manipulating the scene what he says when the curtain's pulled back. He says, "Ignore the man behind the curtain." Meyer then linked the Wizard of Oz narrative to those who had written letters on Harvey's behalf. Those witnesses have not seen or heard the testimony that came out of the witness stand from all of the people who have testified in this case. Those witnesses have not seen all the documents that you have and that you will see during your deliberations. They see one thing. They see the facade on the wall with the smoke in the mirrors. They don't see the man behind the curtain with the levers funneling money into the Reed campaign. They don't see that. You, however, have that benefit. There was a good deal more discussion, then Judge Hicks moved towards a conclusion of the sentencing hearing. While it seemed that Judge Hicks had heard a great deal of the government's argument, it did not fully convince him. You take this serious of a law that goes to our campaign financial disclosures and our reliability and how much faith we can place in our electoral process and in our democracy itself, and take examples of all of these conduit contributions. In one day, family, friends, business associates, every one of those is a felony offense. The evidence shows black and white where the money came from. Mr. Whittemore's personal account, who it went to, his employees, his relatives, and their spouses, all for the purpose of making a phony contribution to Harry Reid's campaign. The evidence was unassailable. No one is above the law, and there simply must be just punishment for criminal conduct involving intentional felony offenses such as these, which many would argue that the court should not depart from the sentencing guidelines that are the beginning point for the court to consider sentence in this case. However, I'm doing that. Instead of the 51 months in jail the U.S. Attorney's Office had argued for in the sentencing memorandum, Judge Hicks sentenced Harvey Whittemore to 24 months in jail, imposed a $100,000 fine, 2 years of supervised release, and 100 hours of community service. After exhausting various appeals, on June 5, 2014, Harvey Whittemore was ordered to surrender to federal prison authorities on August 6, 2014, to begin serving his 2-year prison sentence. It had taken the federal authorities a little over 2.5 years from their raid on Harvey Whittemore and his family and business associates to prosecute him, handle the various appeals, and for Harvey to spend his first day in jail. By contrast, it only took 6 weeks for Judy Mikovits to go from having a civil case filed against her to having a judge who took significant campaign contributions from the Whittemore family and other associates to impose a default judgment on her, all without her having a single day in court to present her case. And during those 6 weeks, she had spent 5 days in jail with no warrant or probable cause of any crime being committed by Mikovits. As much as she might have wanted to, it was difficult for Mikovits to believe that anything close to justice had been done.